Africa, thanks a lot. And it's really fun to be here to talk with her. So I see people who go from physics to biology, but they are at a different stage. So I remember when I was in Chicago, I was a postdoc in astrophysics there.
Oh, you still?
And I decided to, you know, I wanted to. I mean, Philippe had this really cool stuff about individuality in bacteria going on, and I was just fascinated. And so I went to see my PI in physics, and he said, yeah, it's a great idea. And then I said, well, how do I find money? And I think that's the major difficulty of switching from physics to biology, is that you have to find people who are going to fund you. And so we managed to do that. Anyway, so today I'm going to talk about olfaction. And all the work I'm going to tell you about actually was done by Carlotta. If I have time at the end, maybe I can talk to you about also stuff from people who are still in my lab now. But so Carlotta was a physicist from Rome who came to my lab and decided that she wanted to work with real animals or bacteria. And she got, so she basically started knowing nothing about olfaction and finished doing all this work. And as I think you've already seen this kind of diagram a couple of times, but just as a reminder, that so we're going to be interested in the periphery of the olfactory system, and we're going to talk about insects. And the nice thing about the olfactory system, or an interesting thing about the olfactory system, is that you have these olfactory receptor neurons that only express one type of receptor. Each and all the neurons that express the same type of receptor converge, project axons to the same glomeruli, where they make synaptic connection with projection neurons that passes the signal downstream. And so you can think about this array of morines as like independent channels almost. And your odorant molecule will interact with multiple of those channels. So there is a combinatorial aspect to the to encoding odor that I'll touch briefly on. And one of the reasons, actually we already two people in the room who do actively bacterial chemotaxis and something related to olfaction. And in the old days, I'll remind everybody that actually chemotaxis and olfaction had joint conferences. And I would love that to happen again, but I've, I guess the olfactory field has become so big that and the chemotaxis field is very small. But basically bacteria, they are sensing chemicals and they need to, navigate chemical environment. And as Massimo was saying yesterday, they are quite different and type of statistics of the signal that they need to navigate when, for example, they're flying. But when the larvae, for example, maybe is not that different. And so there's a whole continuum, I would say, of different environment from what the bacterium is experiencing to what the fly that's flying is experiencing. And that makes it kind of very interesting because in all cases, you need to recognize some chemical and follow them to get a better life. And the other thing that's very nice is that you can do very, so there's this experiment that really revolutionized the way the bacterial chemotaxis system could be studied, which consists of, so the bacteria have multiple flagella and they rotate them to move around. You can stick them on a piece of glass, on a glass slide, and then you can attach the bead to one of the flagella. And the way they move around is that they go straight and then change direction, straight and change direction. When they go straight, all of those flagella are rotating in counterclockwise direction. And when they change direction, the flagella rotate in the other direction. So if you stick an individual cell and attach a bead to one of the motors, you can, by monitoring the bead, you can measure the instantaneous decision made by a single bacterium that's alive. That's totally cool, And so this is what attracted me to biology. And then I realized when I came to Yale, my neighbor is John Carlson. And so he was doing this kind of experiment. He was planting an electrode. So you have a fly. The antenna is covered with these little sensilla. And in the sensilla, when you blow them up, the size of them is not very far from a bacterium, actually. So this is about 2 micron and about 10 micron long. And this guy here is typically a micron by 1 to 2, depending on where it is in the cell cycle. You know? And inside of those sensilla, you have the dendrites of olfactory receptor neurons. And in the dendrites, you have olfactory receptors that are being expressed. And you have these little pores, and so odorant molecules make their way through those pores and then finally interact with the receptors. And that leads those neurons to generate action potentials. And since there's only 2, 3, or 4, depending on, but typically 2 in many of those, you get different, for each neuron, you get different type of spikes shape. And so you can sort the spikes. Therefore, you can extract a single cell response in vivo, which means you can basically do all of the experiments that I've done there in the same way. I mean, conceptually, you can do the same thing. And I think that was very interesting. Okay, so this technique has been used by John to explore what is called the combinatorial aspect of the odor code, or if you want to call it like that. Basically, he looked at the OR here, the olfactory receptor, and so there's about 50 of them. And what he did is that he expressed one OR, so he deleted the OR from one of the neurons and then expressed one by one that neuron, and then did experiment where you measure the firing rate in response to a puff of different odors. And he went through enormous list of, so now, by now he has done, I think, on the order of 500 of those different odors. And so for each one, then you have, so this is receptor identity, and this is odorant, monomolecular odorant. And you see that, what's interesting is that you see that some receptor respond to several of those odorants, and some of the odorants excite multiple receptors. And then there are also some receptors that respond to very few. So there's some like broad responding receptor and other that are very that are much more narrow, what they call now. So there's a lot of literature on that.
But he defined a response as spiking greater than 50 hertz.
Yes, exactly. So to do this kind of, so there's several caveats to that, of course. One thing is that, first of all, to go through so many odor, they basically used one concentration or maybe 2 concentration, and that's it. And so it's very possible that for some of the odorant, the concentration was not high enough. Or
it's the same for everyone.
The same for everyone, yeah. And so as you can imagine, each receptor will have a different affinity for the different odorant. But still, that was a very early study, and so it gave a huge, basically, it gave the first window, if you want, on the diversity of responses that you can get, and so on.
But the original database has the scalar numbers, though, right?
Sorry?
It has. I thought the database had, even though the paper they just put pluses and minuses, I thought the hell of them, because they have actual numbers, no?
So they have the entire response
of
the firing rate.
Used it for, yeah. Just make sure.
But it's still true that they presented, you know, the same concentration.
Is there a difference between the long dash and the plus?
So, in there, so those neurons, they basically spontaneously generate spikes. Okay, they're firing on the order of like 10, 20 hertz per second. And so when you have a negative, it means that basically there was some sort of inhibition relative to the baseline. When there's dot, is that basically they didn't really see much. And then depending on the number of pluses, it was you know, a low response, or higher and higher. So it's basically, this is just to give a first, you know, a first global picture of what's going on. And similar studies have been done at the level of the PN, and you know, this was in 2006. Since now, there's a lot more data on these kind of things. Okay, and Mark has, you know, measured many of those in the fly, but also in locust, and has been measuring bees, and you know, so this. This kind of principle, the main thing here is that receptor can be either like very narrowly tuned, respond to only few odorant, or there's some that can be broadly tuned, and there's some other one that can actually excite multiple neurons and others that not so many. Okay? So we'll come back to this concept of what's the role of the concentration. You know, when you raise the concentration, of course you're going to start to have more pluses in this table. Okay? Because you go above the threshold for many. And this is an important thing when you think about detecting odor as a function of time. So there's also a temporal aspect. So in the literature you hear, yes?
Is there any relation between the genome and the importance of the odor for the animal, or is it not even measurable?
So there are like a few examples of receptor that it's pretty clear they've been evolved specifically to respond to a specific signal that comes from, for example, a bacterium that could be dangerous for those flies. Okay, so those kind of, so they are like specialists. What I'm more interested in, so a specialist is a no-brainer. No? You basically, if, you know, something that's killing you, the day you find a receptor that responds is very specifically to that, you have a big advantage, and you maintain it. No? The question more that I'm interested in is, and I think a lot of people in this field is, okay, what happened with the generalist part of the olfactory system? What if you synthesize a new molecule that has never been sensed before or never existed before, and you present it, it's going to, some of those receptors will respond. No? How do you detect that there's something new that you didn't know, and so on? All right, so there's a lot of work from Gilles Laurent and Mark Stopfer and many people from this group, but I think Mark worked a lot on that, about also the temporal aspect of the what is called the temporal aspect. So in a simple way, if you look still in the data set from Helisa Alem, which was the postdoc that worked with John Carson doing this big table before, what they were interested in also is the fact that if you have the same odor on multiple different receptors, you see that you get all sorts of different duration of the response and temporal dynamics. You know? And again, if you think a little bit about it, you'll immediately realize that since the affinities of one receptor or another one could be very different, if you have a very sensitive response, a receptor, and you put a certain dose, you're going to respond for a long time. It might even be saturated, and another receptor might barely respond, and so it will be very short. You know? So you can saturate some receptor. So there is an effect of that too that one has to consider. But then there might be also differences between the response function of a receptor, an olfactory receptor neuron, from another one. Okay. And there are data also from Rachel Wilson, which I think was when she was with Gilles Laurent still, showing that there's also differences like that. And so Mark did a nice paper where he basically measured not in the projection, so they took data from the projection neurons, they measure in the locus many projection neurons simultaneously, but I think maybe you're going to talk about it. No. So they measured simultaneously, I think it's on the order of almost 100 projection neurons in the locus, and presented different odors. No? And then, so you get these 100 traces as function of time. You can do dimensional interreduction in the time dimension, and then see that you can basically reduce the data set or project the data set in the low dimensional space. And you find that actually then you have trajectories that are kind of odor specific there. So there's this idea that the coding of odor has both a combinatorial aspect and a temporal aspect. Okay? So I was very interested in this. And I decided that, you know, coming from chemotaxis and not knowing much about all of this, I said, well, why don't we just study very, very precisely the dynamical response of individual odorant in the fly. And the question we decided to ask, or Carlotta decided to ask, was how does the dynamical response of a single odorant depend on the intensity of the odor and on the identity of the odor? Now, can we actually find something or explore that a little bit? And so, in order to do that, since we're going to be interested in the dynamics, One thing that's very important is to think about the dynamics of the signal that exciting the neuron also. Okay, so we realized very, very rapidly that actually we needed to be able to measure very precisely the concentration of odor that's arriving on the fly as a function of time with a very, very rapid time scale. So on the order of like 10 to 15 milliseconds. Okay. And we were lucky because right at that time, a company started to make this photoionization detector. So there were different brands, but one brand had one that was very, very fast. And so this device, what it does, is basically it just sucks a tiny volume of air from an airstream. But what it does is that it does it super fast. So the airstream inside into the PID, so there's a little hole here, this thing is sucking air. And then it passes into a chamber where there's a lamp and basically ionizes all the molecule. And then the voltage difference is basically linearly related to the concentration of odorant. Okay? And so you get a high time resolution measurement of the odor concentration that's arriving on the fly. And so this setup here, we decided to use the classic setup that had been used by the Carlson lab for, you know, almost a decade, because then we could actually relate all of these new studies to all the older studies. You know? So now we have to change this a little bit because we learned about it. But so we have this main airstream, and then on the side here there's a little port, and this is a pastel pipette, and they put a filter of paper filter here, and then puff some others. So this arrangement, we realized very rapidly that, you know, it was a little bit difficult because you put this by hand into the port, and so there's all these like things that are not very precise. So then we replace this with a valve that we put right here and two stream of odors, and so now we can be very precise about controlling the onset of the odor.
So, Tina, did you guys ever measure the flow rate taken by the PID, mini PID?
Yeah, so we have actually two PIDs.
Okay.
So you can also measure like what's the effect of the PID on the signal. You can also measure simultaneously the response of the fly and the PID, and then you can remove the PID and see that the actual response of the neuron is actually very similar.
It is.
Depending on how, so you have to be very careful of how to place the PID. If you place it and, you know, actually create a perturbation in the flow that, you know, deviate the flow away from the antenna, for example, you get all sorts of different things. Another possibility is to put the PID. Oops. VPN. Oh. Sorry. Another possibility is to put the PID right here, behind the fly. Problem is that the fly is big enough. I mean, when you do those experiments, you're actually sticking the fly onto a glass slide and then lowering the antenna, and then you have electrodes coming in. So you have all sorts of things that will basically interrupt the airflow, and so measuring after in this condition is a little bit difficult. But yeah, you can basically arrange things such that the PID is not affecting the response of the neuron. So then, if we, this would be the control signal to the valve, and John Carlson was using half a second puffs with his pipette, so we decided to use the same. And when we used different odorants, we realized that actually different odorants would have very different temporal dynamics in this kind of arrangement. So here what you're looking at is the time trace of the concentration of the odor normalized by the peak. Okay? And done exactly the same for all the other ones. So you see that there's like odor that rise slowly and decay very slowly, and odor that are fast. Okay. So the stimulus dynamics depends on the odor identity in this case. We also looked at what happened if you take.
What causes this difference?
I'll talk about it right now.
It's a matter of one.
Wait for one slide and I'll come. So,
this one slide. So you can Google it in the meantime.
I just want to make this second point and then we'll talk about it. So there's not only a dependency on the identity of the odor. But for some odor, when you change the concentration, you see that basically, as you raise the concentration, it becomes sharper. But for low concentration, you have this slow rise and slow decay. Okay? So, this is... Why do you have that? Well, typically, when you think about the transport equation, like what Massimo was saying yesterday, the transport of a scalar in fluid mechanics is linear. So it's a linear set of equations, which means that if you change the concentration, you should get exactly the same shape. There should be no differences. But this is true away from surfaces. When you have a surface, you're going to get a binding of the odor onto the surface. So if this is the equation of transport, so this is a very simple model, where basically the concentration that's coming out of the pipette is, and phi is the ratio between, so it's the percentage of the flow that's coming in the lateral hole with the odorant. So C0 is the odorant that's injected into the main pipette, and C is the concentration in the main pipette. So this, without that, is just the linear equation you would expect, you know, in those tubes. But there is a binding of the odor on the surface, so theta here is the concentration of the odorant on the surface.
This is a presumption?
No, this is just like standard...
Surface absorption gives rise to the difference. There are equations for sure, but
yes.
Do you know that this is the
effect? Yes, well, so let's go through this.
Let me quickly ask the question for that. What is the concentration that you use? What is the range of concentrations about?
The range of concentration. It goes from basically 10, I don't know, in molecule per volume.
Why don't you say it's percent of saturation? What do you have as a source of odor? You have saturated odor, saturated air.
That's
the headspace of a bottle with odor. And you dilute that somewhere, or you only dilute, how do you do the concentration?
So in this experiment, the way it's done is that basically concentrations were diluted in liquid. So you have a mixture in liquid.
So you always have headspace, except that you have either the neat odorant or dilutions thereof in what?
So in paraffin oil, for example, or some other mineral oil that is not evaporating at all. No. But actually, so nowadays I do the experiment differently, actually diluting gas phase because it's much better. But the point here is that things sticks to surface with a certain rate. So you're gonna have, if this is the concentration of the surface, you have a rate of binding to the surface, and 1 minus theta, so theta goes from 0 to 1 when it's 1, the surface is saturated. When 0, there's nothing on the surface. And W, if you want, is the amount that you can store on the surface. For different surfaces, it's going to be different. And KD is the rate of unbinding from the surface. So it's very simple in the sense that what happens when you bind to the surface is that this term here is nonlinear, because it depends both on the concentration of what you have in the gas phase and the concentration that you have on the surface. And so, if you just assume that, imagine that binding and unbinding to the surface is fast, you keep that in quasi-equilibrium and put this term in the front, and you find that basically the transport equation have this time scale in the front. And there's a lot of literature on that in other fields. It's called the retardation factor. And this retardation factor, you see here immediately that actually it makes sense in the sense that if W is larger, you can put more on the surface, you're going to get a longer time scale. KD is the inverse affinity of the molecule for the surface. So if KD is very large, basically there's low affinity, and therefore this term becomes very small, and the system becomes linear again. If KD is small, then this term becomes important. And you see that it depends on the concentration here, so that gives you the nonlinearity. So you can actually use this to directly fit, you know, many different parts. And you see that, you know, you get all sorts of temple done by just changing a few parameters, the binding rate, the unbinding rate, and the amount that you can have on the surface. Right? So that's just to illustrate where that the physical chemical properties of odorant will affect these signals. And then you can, so for all of those odor that we measured, if we extract, so if you fit just like the beginning here with a double exponential, and the first one, the first rate of increase, you report it into a graph, you find that you have odorant for which when you change the concentration over many different order of magnitude, the time scale of the onset doesn't change much. So we call those the fast odor, they don't interact much with the surface. Well, like for these guys, you see that as you change the concentration, the time scale is decreasing when the concentration increases.
Do you see a correspondence between the actual chemical nature of the odorant? Does it make sense with respect to absorption to glass?
So let's see if I can show you a slide on that.
It's always strange to me because I didn't think that there is very little that absorbs from the surface.
No, actually, and the absorption on surface is not at all simple. So for depending on the molecule, you might have a certain binding rate for first interacting on the surface, and then there's a reorientation of the molecule once it's already bound somewhere on the surface, and maybe it becomes bound twice, and then the rate is much longer. So you have, like, for example, as a function, you see that the vapor pressure simply of the chemical you're using makes a big difference in this characteristic timescale. So you can have characteristic timescale of the onset of the order of second, or on the order of 10 milliseconds. So you have to. But this is something that would be very interesting to study more in detail. So for the moment, I just want to see, okay, what does it mean then for what we're interested in, which is studying the dynamical properties of the ORN. So if you want to study the dynamical response of aura, and you have to be careful and take into account that sometimes your signal might be like this and sometimes might be like that. So these fast orders are nice because basically you can generate the same dynamical input for various concentration. Right? So we're going to first look at the response of a neuron to this kind of order. And then we'll look at what happened when you have this. And so,
if you change the tube, you also get different timescales, I guess.
If you change the material of the tube, you change the radius. So in the formula, there's a little R. If the radius is bigger, you get less of that effect. So it's much better to use a bigger radius, but then it's harder to manipulate odor because you need huge volumes and, So there's a trade-off. All right. So how does the ORN response dynamic depend on the intensity of a fast odor? So ethyl acetate is one of those fast odors. And so here you're just looking at, this is a puff of paraffin oil, and the dots are the spikes. There's 12 repeats for each concentration. And these numbers here are the dilution in the liquid phase of the pure odor with the paraffin oil. It's like how in this field, basically, most people use that. And as you increase concentration, you see that the neuron starts to respond. And then at the end, start to saturate. And this is the corresponding firing rate. And so what was interesting, so if you plot the peak of the response, you get this kind of dose response. And then what's interesting is that if you take all of the response in this part of the dose response, where there's no, you're basically in the very sensitive range of the neuron, you find that you can rescale those responses, and they kind of collapse on a similar shape. So you can rescale the input, and you can rescale the output. So that seems to indicate that the differences between these responses is just a question of amplitude, but the temporal aspect is not very different. And we can look at that. So here we were averaging over multiple flies and multiple neurons. But then we decided to look at individual neurons. So here you have, for an individual neuron, multiple concentration rescaled. So these are three different neurons. This is AB3A, one of the neurons, and that's one type of odor. We can put on the same neuron, a different order, and see also similar kind of scaling, you can change neuron, different orders. And you see that more or less you always kind of, the single neuron seem to be able to exhibit a similar dynamical response for various concentration. And so then we compare here the variance. So if you take the mean and then take the variance around the mean of those curves, so you can do this variance across neurons for the same concentration, or you can do across concentration for the same neuron. And so you see that there's more variability from neuron to neuron than in the same neuron for different dilution, which is interesting. So then we ask ourselves, well, is this maintained even if you put a background of the odor for, you know, on that neuron? So if it's an important, if it's an important property for the fly to be able to generate the same response for a different concentration, it should also be true that if you put a background of that odor, the system should be able to adapt and still generate the same response. If not, then, you know, it's kind of useless, because in any kind of situation, you could not use that. So we decided to, this is like Howard Berg, no, this is Julius Adler's experiment in bacterial chemotaxis done with the fly. Basically, you put a step, establish a background, and then you put puffs, and do the dose response on top of the background. No? So the response to the onset of the step are provided here, and we did three different backgrounds. So, and what's reported here is the maximum firing rate for each increasing background. And so, and we normalize the curve, and you see that, again, you have similar dynamics for that. But the interesting thing is that then, on top of this background, we can do these dose response of puffs. And so, the pink, the light pink here is when there's no background, is the dose response I was showing before. Then we put a background which generated a peak here at 93 hertz, so it's a low background. And then, so if this is 93 hertz here, you know, this must be like something like 20 or something.
So I use the same or different background?
Same background, same odor.
So puffs and background are the same?
Yes, same. So then
the neuron presumably responds to both.
Sorry?
The neuron responds to both the background and the...
Yes, signal. It's the same odorant.
Same odorant?
Same odorant, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. So we put in the same odorant, we adapt the neuron to a background of an odorant, and then we see if the neuron is still able to respond to fluctuation above that background. Which would be very important, for example, you know, if you have, when you get closer to the source and you still want to detect fluctuation of plumes and things like that, for example. So you see here that the dose response on top of increasing background shift to the right, which basically suggests that the neuron is adapting its sensitivity, as you would want to do. But then the important question is, okay, what happened to the dynamics of the response for this puff, like around this region of those response, are they similar or not? And you see that...
What is the concentration of the background?
Sorry?
What is the concentration of the background?
So the concentration of the background in this case, we had like a hard time measuring it because of the PI. So in this experiment, we have to set the background and the puff on top and so on. So that's why I'm reporting instead the firing rate of the neuron, the peak that's reached for the onset of the background.
If you were to test the background and show, where would it be on the left to right scale?
Yeah, you say, okay, where's this background here?
Yeah.
I don't know very precisely that for this experiment. The only thing I know is that I'm increasing the background, and then the dose response is shifting.
But you have some idea, though. Your lightest pink is without a background.
Yes.
So that gives you your 93 hertz range, right?
Yes.
Yes, but it's not.
But
it's not very magical. It's.
I have much more. I have new data that's to address that question. We could talk about it later. But the point here was that the question here was, when you are responding on fluctuation on top of increasing background, is your dynamic changing? And it doesn't change much. And we did that for this order, but we did it also for different orders. And you see that those responses have different shape for different orders. And that's to be expected also because the odorant have different affinities for those, for the same receptor. But the interesting thing is that the dynamics of the response don't change much. They change much less. Okay?
Jadi, why is it harder to measure the concentration in this setup than previously?
The reason she had a hard time is because of I think that basically you have to have a bottle, so you have to have a bottle with a liquid inside and a headspace, and then you're flowing in a background of odor. Where like the puffs are delivered in a different way. They deliver by putting odor on a piece of paper in a pastel pipette and then puffing air through it. And so the correspondence between the resulting number of molecules in gas phase between those two techniques of, you know, basically evaporating odors is very difficult to study. I mean, basically it's very hard to do. The only thing you can do is compare with the PID, no? And so at the end, what matters really for this question is, what was the peak reached by the neuron? You know the dose response. So we know from those, we have this, you know, we have this dose response, like he was saying. So this is the dose response on top of nothing. So now you just look at 93, you go here, and so this background is here. So this 93 is this one. And 140 is around here. So this is the background, etc. But it's a bit, that's why I, it's much better to actually use pure odorant in a bottle, flow in, and then you make dilution in gas phase. And then you can do all of these things. So we do that now, and then we have none of those problems. And actually, if you're interested, if we have time, which I don't know, I can show you. But so the point here, again, is these responses have very similar dynamics. And so, just to summarize this first part, and then I'm going to come back on that. The response amplitude seems to increase with stimulus intensity, and the response dynamics exhibit some sort of invariance to the stimulus and the background intensity. Of course, I'm only considering, you know, this zone of this region of the dose response. I'm not talking about what happened here or at saturation. All that will break down at saturation. Or at the bottom here, you know, if the neuron is just starting to respond, you're going to get something else. So now we can take the same neuron and present different odor and look at what happened to the dynamics. How different are they? And so this time we took fast odor and then slower and very slow odor. And what's interesting, you see that now this is the same neuron responses. You see immediately that the response of the neuron is convolved with the input, of course. And so you have large differences here, but a lot of it probably comes from the fact that the input has large differences.
It's molecular weight, basically.
Sorry?
It's molecular weight.
Yeah, molecular weight is very important, yes. Yes. So, you know, and you can do that for that neuron, but it's not specific to that neuron. You can do for other neurons, and you get the same kind of things. No? And you see that when the odor is fast on different neurons, you get these kind of like typical shapes. So the shape is slightly different because those are different neurons responding to the odor. But you know, they kind of like respond to a fast odor. When you have this long tail in the signal, your neurons will have these kind of long tails. Okay. So in order to extract, if you really want to understand the dynamical properties of the neuron, one of the difficulties that you're going to have is that you have to deconvolve this from the response. It's to extract the actual response of just the neuron. And so Carlotta, you know, to do that, basically use this kind of standard method in neuroscience of basically using linear and nonlinear modeling. So this is a very simple thing. You're assuming that the firing rate is a nonlinear function that's static, that take as an input a filtered stimulus. So you have a linear filter and a static nonlinearity. And there are multiple techniques to do that. So the first thing that we did is to say, well, what is the linear nonlinear model from the electric signal to the valves to the actual signal that arriving on the fly? And you see here that the filter that you extract has this kind of integrating shape, and the nonlinear part is actually just linear. So our delivery system is linear. So those you can just check it like that. So now, if you can extract a filter from this signal to the neuron response. So here you see that the neuron, for many, many trials, is very, very precise in following that signal. Can on, off, etc., following this signal.
Just to make sure, the stimulus is now your PID measurement, right?
So
when you said the red trace, that's...
Yeah. So that's the PID measurement, that's the neuron, the measure simultaneously, okay? And this is the corresponding firing rate for all of those recordings. So you can use a piece of data from that you didn't use to extract the filter, and then show that you can actually predict with this linear, nonlinear, with that filter and that nonlinear mapping very well the response. So here you have the filter for the ORN. So now it's the filter from here to here. And this is the nonlinear part of this model, and it's basically a rectifier. No? Because when you have a linear filter, you're going to get negative numbers. And so those are kind of shut down.
And the filter is adapted, right? It's perfectly adapted.
The filter is perfectly adapted, although I'll come back to that. I'll check that later.
And this negative peak is, I don't know, 50 milliseconds? No, it isn't. Does it correspond to some inhibition that sits on, or you don't know, in your filter?
So when you look at the response, there is a little blank often afterwards. So yes, it corresponds to that. But so the question again is, okay, now what happens if I take another odor? If I take, so this is a fast odor, you see that the neuron is the on, off. If I take a slow odor, so this is a slower odor. So what happened with that odor is that when you do that stimulus, if you measure with the PID with this one, you get basically, and you do a histogram of the intensity, you get two peaks, a very low and a high peak. If you do that with this one, you get a Gaussian around mean. So this is a small fluctuation around mean. But like those are like big fluctuation, like Massimo was talking about more yesterday. And you see that the neuron now has a harder time shutting down and on and off. But it's basically because the signal is more like that. Right? And this is the firing rate, and you see the firing doesn't bottom down to zero. Where like here, the neuron really goes down to boom, zero, silent, and then fires again. Right? So you can extract both filter for both cases. And these are the filter for the delivery system. And you see that for the fast odor, it's the same at the beginning, but then there's a big difference. And that comes from the sticking of the odor to the surface. And so this one has a much longer integrating tail, that filter. Okay. Now, if you...
Can I just say very quick, so for the fastest odor, did you sort of guess the bandwidth of the valve clicking that you need by experience? Or because you can always go much, much faster. Right?
Yeah, so there is a kind of a trade-off between... So what you're trying to do is put white noise on the system. Theoretically, you should have white Gaussian noise on the system, which is impossible to do with odor. So you always, you know, if you look at the paper in Vision, it's great because for them, they can do the stimulus they want. It's like amazing. But with odor, it's super hard to do that. So you're kind of limited by the fact that there's always going to be some sort of autocorrelation in the signal. And you want that to be at the fastest possible time scale, okay? So at high frequency. And that's also the reason why you have this little wiggling in the filter when you extract. So, but the interesting thing is, when you extract the filters in the, you know, from that data set, from that data from the same neural, they look very, very similar. Well, like, these two filters, they are quite different. And so the question was, well, if they're so similar, maybe we can predict this response just using the red filter. So one filter should be able to predict both responses. So that's what we did here. So we used this, the filter that had been extracted with the fast odor, and then we fed the PID signal for the slow odor into that. And what we get is this response. So basically, the same model can predict the response to both of those different signals that are very different, no? And the different odor. So what this is indicating is that, at least for the large timescale differences in the response of those neurons, it's basically mostly dominated by these large differences we anyway had in the input, which makes total sense, no? From a signal theory point of view. And so that can dominate the response. It can, yes?
Question. So that filter, I could almost think of that as a second derivative Gaussian, except that the lobes are not symmetric. Mm-hmm. Is that something, what should I learn from that?
I don't know yet. So we are actually studying now how the shape of this might change, etc. So I don't have a intelligent answer yet.
But in general, most neurons you basically have at least a positive and a negative. You always have a peak in the thing. It's more.
Well, but you can have you could have, you know, just a peak. So you could have an integrating type of neuron with
you
a
much lower. You say most biophysically most neurons do have that.
And I think when you look at neuron to different neuron, these relative differences are different for different neurons. And I mean, you would expect that they're going to be different. So this is an interesting aspect. Like, it would be very, it would be great if we could now extract, like, you know, what is the diversity in the shapes that you actually have in this. And maybe we can do it with this setup. So we're trying to get there. But one thing, yeah?
Why does it go to negative times, or is this, was it non-causal kernel?
Yeah, so this wiggling here comes from the fact that in the input is not perfect white noise, it's correlated. Okay? And so when you extract the filter, you have basically to inverse a matrix. And when you inverse a matrix with some zero, basically you blow up. And so the standard technique to do that is to basically people regularize the matrix by adding a tiny constant. And this kind of thing gives rise to this ringing.
No, but why do you have negative time there? That's what I
mean. Here?
Yeah.
So the negative time comes from, so you know, the neuron should be like this and then on. But this sharpness, you cannot extract that. So this regularization will give you both in the front and the back. So now, what I'm saying here is that basically, if you have big differences in the input stimulus dynamic, you're going to get large difference in the output. And actually, it's interesting because you can actually do experiment where you have mixtures. And one of the components of mixture is fast, but the other one is slower and tend to stick more to surfaces. And so if you have a fast excitatory odor, here this is the red PID onset, and then you look at the response of the neuron, you get this typical shape, the red one. Now if you mix that one with a slow inhibitory odor, for that neuron, the linalool was for AB2A, the linalool basically tend to shut down the response. Okay. But it's a slower odor. You see that when you have both mixed, the onset is the same as in the red. But because this guy is dominating, he's coming faster. But then as this guy catch up, it shuts down the response. You can do the contrary. You can put a fast inhibitory odor and a slow excitatory odor. And when you get the slow excitatory odor only, you have this kind of slow response. And when you mix the two, since the inhibitor is faster, it shuts down first the neuron, and then you have the effect of the other guy coming. And by the way, this is done using receptors for mosquito expressed in the fly. So it's not even specific to the to the fly system. Okay. So the zero order understanding of what's going on here, you can make a zero order model, which is you take the red filter I had been extracting before. You know, so you take one filter and you assume that the excitatory and inhibitory order are just additive. So it's one minus the other one, you know, as a signal. And then you just use a Poisson cascade LN model, and behind the LN you put a Poisson cascade firing rate type of neuron. And you can reproduce these kind of differences very easily. Okay? So the interesting thing is that the different chemistry of the molecule, even though they're traveling together, if there's a surface that might delay one component relative to the other, and now start to shape the actual time-dependent response of the neuron, which opens all sorts of questions that we can come back later. It's just, and that, by the way, was done. So Qing Su was a postdoc in John Carson's lab, and she was studying mixture responses. And it was just crazy data. It was impossible to understand until Carlotta had all her data on the speed of the order, and then everything became clear. And so this is published in a different paper. So how does, so you can ask, well, I show that the different dynamics of the signal cause differences in the response of the neuron. So now what if we try to remove that? Is there still differences left in the filters of the neuron, of a single neuron to multiple order? Okay? So here, what I'm showing you is the filter of the delivery system for pairs of odor. There's always the methylbutyrate, and then, so we'll be doing the filter for this one alone or for this one alone. You see that these guys are slower odor and tend to stick more. These guys, and so on. Right? These ones are very, like, basically, the stimulus dynamics is exactly the same that arise on the fly. And same here. And so then we present these two stimulus, one after, you know, after the other, on this neuron. And this is a neuron in the maxillary pulp, which is even in a different part of the fly head. And these are the filter of the ORN response, so odor to ORN. And you see that their shape for the same neuron are not very different. Well, we found that there's like these kind of shifts. So there's one is displaced relative to the other. And we don't know where that comes from. But so it's possible that the odor identity causes delays, or there are delays that are odor identity dependent. But this is something to be explored further. I mean, I don't have...
supposedly at a receptor level.
It could be the transport of the molecule from the outside to the receptor. It could be... yeah, many things like the rate of capturing the molecule to the pore. It's not, it, but yeah, it could be at the receptor, at the, as you said, like the receptor dynamic may be slightly different. So we see these kind of time delays. When you, and we can check that actually, so if you correct for that delay, you can use one filter to actually predict the response of the to the other odor, and very well, and you see that basically make very good prediction. So basically the filter is not very different, it's just that it's shifted in time. So if you don't shift, you get a delay in your response. And delays are interesting because they are like, I think in mammalians, so now you guys are the specialists, but there's been papers about the fact that, you know, delay in the onset is very important. So which neurons start first and second and third is very important for coding. So now the question that Massimo was asking, so is this filter basically adapt, you know, is after the neuron has adapted to this fluctuating signal? So, you know, we have this kind of adaptation here. And the question is, well, in this model, what is changing, the filter or this? And so you can look, you can do this fluctuating signal for a long time and look at what happened and extract the filter and the nonlinear part of the response at the beginning and at the end of this trace. And if you compare both, you see that the filters, early and late, is exactly the same. Never changes. But what changes is the gain. Okay? So the gain of the of the system is changing, but the linear response is not really changing.
Well, presumably it's changing in one direction, it's always going down later.
Yeah, because in those early days it was hard to maintain, you know, the concentration very, very flat. So the linear gain adapts when the linear filter is invariant. And so now actually I have a graduate student who has been studying this and has studied how the gain is modulated in the olfactory receptor neurons. And I could talk about that later maybe a little bit. So now, what are the implications for, so early on we asked ourselves, well, you know, if there are differences in the input, could you actually recognize odor based on that? And then I'll but there's a big caveat. Caveat, you said? Okay. There's a big caveat with doing that. But the simple question was, okay, what is the contribution of a single ORN to discriminating between odor? Since the signals here for different odorant in this situation where it's closed from two surfaces are so different, and the response are different as a consequence, you should be able to just classify, do PCA on those time traces, and classify the odor and even the concentration. And if you just run PCA, you just take the first two principal components, you can, you know, separate all the odors, and you can even separate concentrations. Okay. But if there's no difference, if you take multiple odors that have the same dynamics, you should absolutely not be able to do that. And this is the case. So now if you all use like fast odors that are all like this for the same neuron, you cannot classify anything. And so I really like this plot because it's showing the two, you know, aspects of odor coding. There's a temporal, but there's a combinatorial aspect. So you're going to need combinatorial coding to do that. There's no way you can use the time information. Maybe the time information might help or make it easier to separate, but basically you're going to have to rely on that at some point. And so this is just an illustration of the two aspects of what it means to detect odor. So this is not the end of the talk, but the first part of what I talked about is that one ORN responds with the same type of linear filter to many ORN, not large differences. The large differences, and when you change concentration from background to, and change the background, you still get the same kind of responses. And maybe that's because the filter is not changing. When we were fluctuating, the filter was remaining the same. So it goes in hand with the fact that when you put a little puff or a higher puff, you also respond the same way. Large differences in the ORN dynamics are often just the result of the convolution of, you know, large differences in the input. And we observe some small delay. So the actual differences in the response of the neuron to the different odorant is seen in terms of delays. So then you can ask, well, okay, is this relevant outside of the lab? Because this is kind of contrived. Now you say, okay, you have this pipette, and you're blowing stuff through the pipette. So basically, all what you're telling us is that all those are artifacts of doing experiment. And it's true, no? It's like, I'm just telling you, sticking to the pipette is a big problem. So we decided to, well, what happened if, you know, is there, if an odor is slow in my pipette, will it be slow in some sort of more natural type of, as you know, the word natural here is crazy, but so natural type of situation. And so Carlotta, this experiment that I really liked a lot, so she put a piece of paper on a surface, on a table, and it was in a room, there was no, you know, she barely moved and anything, so we're trying to have not much to fluctuation or anything. And then she has the PID sucking air above that and let it let it go for a while so that basically there's a constant flow of air. No? And then what she does, she put a drop of pure odorant of one of those guys on here. Okay? And so this big fluctuation here is when she comes with the pipette and put the drop. And then with the fast odorant, what you get is that is very, very fast evaporation. And what you're seeing is the decay in the concentration at the source, really. The source is being depleted, and very soon there's no more odor, and that's it. But with slow odor, what you see is that you have a rise and then a decay. And for this very slow odor, the decay is like down here. Okay. So what was interesting is that the guys who were slow in this experiment, slow in this experiment or fast in this experiment, but also the guys who were slow and fast in the pipette system. And so there seem to be these different classes of odor. Some that they like surfaces and some that don't so much. And they some that evaporate fast and evaporate not so fast. And so this is all to be explored. I mean, this is just brushing the surface. No? So then we ask ourselves, well, what happened?
The phenomenon of long lingering for what feel to be higher molecular weight odorants is natural because the volatility is lower. And for the same amount, say in grams, it can take much longer to evaporate. The total drop is there. It's a different phenomenon than absorption to the glass.
But they're related because we found that the guys who are slow here are also slow on the other one.
Well, that's not enough to say that it's the same phenomenon.
No, I'm not saying it's the same. I'm saying that there's an interesting problem here to be studied. And actually, if you go into the literature, in the chemical engineering literature, you find that the some people who have a lot of money who have studied that in detail, and those are the perfumers. And so the perfumers have mathematical model of evaporation from, you know, a bottle and liquid in a bottle and so on and so on, because it's very important
for them is evaporation from the skin.
And also so they have all of these model where they're looking at what is the arrival time of the different notes or different compounds within a perfume.
Right.
So perfume is this very complex mixture, and for example, if there is one part of the that's very volatile, it's a problem because then you would just smell that, and then you don't get the actual mixture.
It's like design. Perfumes here, but it's something called the top note and the base note. And
yes.
The top note is what you smell immediately after application to the skin.
Yes.
Everything in the skin, the bottles don't care.
Sure.
Although in the duty free, you sometimes smell from the bottle, but basically some stay, and perfume can stay for 2 days.
Yeah.
If it's base note, because it absorbs strongly to the skin and it's low volatility.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do you make your understanding of the fly nose better by knowing all of that?
Well, so there's how much you stay on the surface, and then once you evaporate this from the surface, basically, like, the rate of evaporation of the surface is what's important too. If some compound evaporate faster than others, basically, you know, what you get into the air is different ratios of concentrations.
The delay.
So this could be interesting.
In the very early slide, you show that some odorants, and also for some concentrations, you see a longer delay of arrival to the PID, right?
And also a longer delay of the
decay. Removal, yes. So the first delay has to do with the fact that an odor will absorb more to the glass surface. So en route to the PID, something is lost.
Yeah.
And it takes more and more supply to bring sufficient amount to the PID.
Yeah.
And indeed, when you do the off, it's about desorption. And desorption is slow. But there are two phenomena here. One is that the longer molecules tend to absorb more. The short molecules just don't absorb. They are transparent to the glass, or the glass is transparent to them. So this is a long discussion, but we can get into infinite detail on that without understanding the nose better.
Yes.
So and I appreciate your tendency to think of how to understand the nose. So
So one question we wanted to ask is, well, if you're a fly and you're sitting somewhere downstream from a source that's like that, but now there's a stream of air, okay, what do you see? And so we did that experiment where we measure simultaneously, and this is downstream, is very short. This is a normal slide, okay? So to give you a scale. And so you have the fly and the PID measuring simultaneously, and here you get the fluctuations. So this is the signal you see in the PID, and this is the firing rate from the neuron, okay? And we did that with a fast odor and with a slow odor. And you see here what I was saying before, that for the slow odor, you basically rise to some mean level, and then you have this kind of fluctuation around this mean. Well, like for this guy, you tend to have up, down, up, down, up, down.
So the source of odor is just a drop.
Yeah.
There is only pure air from the glass, a pipette.
Yeah. Okay. So now what we looked at is, what is the characteristic time scales of the fluctuation that you would detect here? So we just take the autocorrelation function of this part of the signal here. And you see that for the fast odor, you have, you know, shorter characteristic time scale than for the slow odor, as you would expect. What's interesting is that in the neuron, you also see the autocorrelation function, the response of the neuron, also show these kind of differences. So that means that, you know, if you are basically comparing, if you're able as a fly or as an insect or any animal to take an to detect the characteristic timescale of the fluctuation, you could know that there's a difference. You know. That's all what I'm saying. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I think to answer Doran's thing, you came in a little bit late. I think one of the points was that previously people claimed that the neurons in the fly nose gives completely different timescale of responses to different odors, claiming that the neuron is acting differently to different odors. And his point, I think, is that, well, the neural kernel is the same, but stimulus dynamics outside the world is accounting for a lot of it.
Except for the delay, and other little...
I think that the differences in the neurons are on a much shorter timescales. And those large differences...
Which I think is very important, because people went off on a tangent trying to say, like, you know, the same neuron can detect different odors with, like, all kinds of crazy GPCRs.
And then you have to take a second, you know, caveat to that. So I'm talking about what are called the OR, but there's multiple families of olfactory receptors, the GR, IR. They will have, you know, many, many, many different type of receptors. And so this is just like a little window on one type of particular, you know, that oldest family that was first found, and you know, but you know,
there's also odor binding proteins.
Yeah, and there's also odor binding proteins. So in the sensillum, there are some odor binding proteins that are in the lymph of where, you know, around the dendrites of the neuron, and there's the belief to help, and so there's some cases where it's clear that they are necessary to send some sort of odorant. And by the way, in bacterial chemotaxis, there's also responses that are mediated by an intermediary that takes the signal and bring it to the receptor. So, you know, we know that for a long time. And but the OBP role is still very, very unclear, actually. So what I was just trying to show you is that basically, when we did this with Carlotta, what it made me really realize is that there's actually two worlds of olfaction. There's the world of olfaction away from surfaces, and you know, the classic experiment like Massimo was talking about yesterday, where you have these very large moths. They are a bit like that big, and they fly, and in those experiments, actually, they even had like cable dangling behind them, and they're still able to fly, you know. They're like airplane, no? So it's high Reynolds number away from surfaces, etc. Then there's all of these insects that live on surfaces, and they all have a sense of smell. And so for those insects, interaction with surfaces, what does it do? That's the big question I have for all of you guys. So here is just like to show that the fruit fly, which is the organism we were using, spend a lot of its time just walking on the surface. So this is a survival curve for food fight. No? So probability to survive is 1 in the beginning, and then as the age of the fly goes, probability to survive goes down too. But you know, they last about, it's like 1 day for 1 year for us, you know, about same thing. And then as we do, when they're little babies, they move around like my kids, and then when you get older, you know, you kind of do less. But what you see is that you walk a lot and you don't fly so much as a fruit fly.
Okay. We should call it a walk fly.
Yeah.
Food walker.
All right, so the conclusion, I already talked about this. What I think is, what I'd like to, you know, really imprint in your head is that there are two worlds of olfaction, I think. There's away from surfaces, the transport is linear. And so if you have a plume, even if you have a mixture in the plume, there's going to be tiny differences in the diffusivity of the molecules. But that, Massimo will tell you that this is not going to make a big difference because the thing is dominated by turbulence anyway. Okay, and so all of the compound in the same plume will basically arrive on the animal that's flying through that exactly the same time. On the surface, it's different because you have all those interactions and they have a different rate for each compound. So then the question is, what happened, you know, to if you have a source that's interesting here that has multiple compounds as function of the distance, well, do you lose component, or are there components of that source that are really unreliable because they stick to the surface here and here and here, and so basically you get absorption, desorption, and basically scrambling of positional information, and maybe some compound in the source are actually more volatile and travel fast, and so maybe those insects have to pay attention to those, but not the one that. So I don't know. So those are all like questions that I think are food for thought for people who do experiment and people who do theory. All right. And with that, so the person who did all of this is Carlotta. Now she's in Germany. She's in Göttingen. So she's a Humboldt fellow and doing an experiment. She's decided to go deeper and she's working on projection neurons and so on. And there was Jean Su who helped us. Dennis Matthew was a postdoc with, so those two were postdoc with John Carlson. And John was my partner in crime in all of this. Thanks.
So there are also, I guess this maybe relates to those 9, 12 millisecond latencies you were saying. They're carrying, even if they're flying, they're carrying a surface with them, the surface of their antenna or cuticle elsewhere in the body. Is that something that do you think that they're using the information about interaction with the surface of their antenna, or is that something in order to deal with information, to deal with students? Or do you think it's something that they have to filter out and they can function despite the fact that it's...
So I would imagine that would really make sense is to get rid of anything that sticks to the surfaces. And actually, I think that they express some enzyme that would degrade other ion on the surface. Because if you have, basically to sense something, the big problem is to get rid of the signal so that you can sense again. That's what you want to do. Okay. And so even if you think about what's happening in the sensillum, what's very important is to remove, once you sense a molecule, you want to get rid of it so that you can sense the next one. And so I think that whatever they do, they're going to have a very fast degradation machinery to get rid of the signal. So I would assume that the interaction with the surface there might not be like so important for that. But one thing I'm interested in is the fact that there's, you know, this whole structure. So at the very beginning, if you look at, that's a nice food mechanics problem. So if you look at the morphology of those guys, no? So they have different type, and they have like large basiconic, you should tell the name.
I can't pronounce it.
What's the name of this? trichoid, and there's a third type.
There's filiform.
Filiform. So they have very different morphology. See, there's those big guys, then there's this long, thin one, and then there are this like thing that curve the tip. You know? And some of them look like more like a cactus with like, you know, those creases, and the holes are all along the crease. Now these guys that are more like this. And so why having these different morphologies? Okay? Why having in each one of those two neurons? Those are all questions that nobody knows the answer really.
Epsis.
Sorry?
Infarctic.
Yeah. So
that seems bad.
Could be part of the protein.
Yeah, it could be. But so the you get one thing that one could do is basically if you get a 3D scan of this, then you could do a simulation like she was talking about yesterday. And my question is, what is the rate of basically encounter of tracers with the different sensillum? Is it dependent on the shape and the concentration of them, the way they're placed or not? And is there like some sort of filtering that's happening like that? Or is there a delay? I don't know.
I don't know this. Most of these are also mechanosensitive. Is that true? I don't know in your software, but in many.
They often have a mechanosensory neuron.
So it might be a separate neuron.
In addition,
I think Rachel Wilson did an experiment where she actually blew wind faster and slower and didn't really see any big difference.
Yeah, and then again, there was a controversy because somebody had claimed that there was, and I think now, from what I understand from Rachel particularly, that's wrong.
Yeah.
It's a Johnson's argument, that's a separate point.
There's an effect?
It is not. That
there's no effect.
There's not. That effect is very minor. Because we also know there's a controversy in mammalian and vertebrates, which I think also many people don't believe. So maybe we stop and have an informal discussion just to give time for Mark to start at 11:30. I don't want to do that. I hate to stop the discussion, but so we can just go on and have coffee or whatever and keep talking to you. Thank you again.
Thanks. Thank you.